Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Addiction Audio Podcast. My name is Ben Scher, and I'm delighted to be joined today by three academics in the United States. So, to start, we have Dr. Gabriella Kazanov, who is a clinical psychologist and a research associate in the Center for Mental Health at the Perelman School of Medicine in Philadelphia. And she is also a research psychologist at the Philadelphia VA. Next, we have Professor Jim McKay, who is a professor in psychology in psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. And last but definitely not least, we have Professor Richard Rawson, who is a professor in psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at the Semel Institute, UCLA. So welcome, welcome all. Before we dive into kind of the questions to do with your recent paper, I thought it'd just be useful to go around and for you guys just to introduce yourselves and just discuss a bit about your expertise and your areas of research. So just from left to right on my screen, Dr. Kazanov, would you mind starting us off?
Yeah, of course. So I lead implementation of contingency management at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And then I also am interested in researching ways to improve engagement and treatment among patients and providers, specifically for substance use disorders and then to prevent suicide as well.
Brilliant. And next we have Professor McKay.
Yes, hi, thanks. My work is really focused on developing and testing continuing care interventions for people with substance use disorders, really how to manage these disorders over longer periods of time. I've also been very interested in how to address non-response when people get a good treatment, but they don't seem to get better. And finally, I'm interested in the remote delivery of treatment.
Professor Rawson.
Hi. My work has been primarily in the area of stimulant use disorder. I've done a long series of studies in the area of methamphetamine and cocaine use. And one of the sets of studies I did was on efficacy for contingency management. And I did a couple of NIDA grants back in 20 years ago. Recently, contingency management is starting to be more widely used in the United States. And I'm involved now in a lot of the implementation efforts for contingency management in a number of states around the United States.
Brilliant. So before we did the introductions, I forgot to give the title of the paper, which would be really important to our listeners. So the title of the paper is "Should Contingency Management Protocols and Dissemination Practices Be Modified to Accommodate Rising Stimulant Use and Harm Reduction Framework?" So a lot to unpack there. But the first question I kind of had is, what is contingency management, and what is the evidence that surrounds it as a practice?
Yeah, so contingency management is a structured treatment in which financial incentives are provided to encourage abstinence from a substance. It can be used for a variety of outcomes, but it's mostly used to promote abstinence from substances and specifically from stimulants. So contingency management for stimulant use disorder is the best supported form of contingency management and the one that has the most studies to support it. And studies have found over and over again in hundreds of studies and at least 10 to 20 meta-analyses that it's the most effective treatment for stimulant use disorder, especially given that we don't have many other treatments. So there are no FDA-approved medications for stimulant use disorder. And all of those studies show that contingency management is even better than typical treatments for substance use disorders, so things like cognitive behavioral therapy and other treatments like that.
And so given all of this evidence, would you say that contingency management is widely implemented?
Yeah, so it is not at all widely implemented. So historically, the Department of Veterans Affairs has been the only entity to implement it in any systematic way, and it remains the only health system to have implemented it at scale. But as Dr. Rawson noted, there are now some efforts to implement contingency management in other settings as well. So California has a really big implementation effort that's been going on for the last few years. Montana and Washington do as well.
As Gavi says, we've had the evidence for 30 years that contingency management works, but it hasn't been used. What's driving this current interest is that in the United States, we have an overdose crisis, and 50% or more of the individuals who overdose have cocaine or methamphetamine use as part of their overdose. And it's the desire to reduce overdose deaths that's causing states to now say, okay, we need to have something that works for cocaine and methamphetamine, and contingency management is our only tool on the shelf that has robust evidence. So it's encouraging to see states now start to use it as the VA has for a decade.
I think it's just, it's important to stress though, that if you, for the vast majority of people, if they walked into their nearby treatment program and asked for contingency management, it would not be available there. So even though there are these big state initiatives going on, it's typically just not part of what's offered in treatment. So that's something that really needs to change.
Why has it not kind of taken off given the evidence base so far? What are some of those reasons?
I think at least one reason is that there are sometimes like ethical or other issues that people have with a provision of financial incentives for abstinence. You know, thoughts like, why are we paying people to do something they should do anyway? Or why are we offering incentives in this context? And one thing we note in the paper is that that's really changed over the last 10 or so years. So the attitude that providers have towards delivering this treatment has really changed. And there's a lot more acceptance of it among providers and healthcare systems and all of that. And then there are also lots of systemic barriers to the implementation of contingency management that we go into in the paper. So like policy changes that need to be made to allow it to be delivered at scale. And also the expense of providing incentives is something that has come up.
Okay, brilliant. So now just turning to the paper. So would you mind just telling us a bit about, what was the aim of the study? And particularly, why is it important to understand contingency management within the context of stimulant use and harm reduction?
So as Dr. Rossin mentioned, stimulant use has really increased in the last 10 years in the US, and stimulant-related overdoses are becoming or are currently a huge problem. And then the other background is that there is an embracing of harm reduction frameworks, which really prioritize reductions in use as opposed to only abstinence as a desired outcome. And so in the paper, we talk about how the current CM protocols, which were originally developed in the 1990s, may not sufficiently account for some of the recent changes that we've noted. And so the idea of the paper was to propose potential ways that contingency management protocols and also dissemination practices could be updated to address rising and more lethal stimulant use and also harm reduction frameworks. And one thing that's really important to note is that these are all proposals for change that could be effective. They haven't been tested yet. And so one thing we also mention is the need to figure out if these are actually effective modifications and what's needed to get CM to the point that it can impact population levels of stimulant use.
And would one of you be able to go into a bit of detail on maybe one or two of these proposals? Just to give our listeners an idea of what some of those are.
So just one example of you know, addressing rising stimulant use and access to treatment is to change CM protocols to emphasize really engaging and retaining patients in treatment. So one specific proposal that we made that, you know, for that aim is, you know, right now with contingency management protocols, you start at a lower incentive value and then you increase over time until it gets to the point where you're making more money for abstinence because you're incentivizing these long periods of abstinence. But it's also a time that a lot of patients drop out of treatment in the beginning when they're not earning as much. And so one proposal we make is to potentially start with a higher incentive at the beginning, which would mean escalating more slowly. So the escalation wouldn't be the focus. It would be sort of more that initial offer of incentives to keep patients engaged and not dropping out of the treatment.
And one of the reasons why that might be particularly important now is because the strength and the purity of the drugs are up considerably compared to the 1990s. And so you may need a more powerful incentive at the beginning to counteract the higher incentive of the drug, that it's just giving the people who use it a stronger euphoric reaction. So you really need to have something a little more powerful to counteract that, to get the person engaged and to keep them for those initial weeks.
And what types of incentives are we talking about here? Is there big variation in terms of the amount that's given to people?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There are two types of contingency management. One is called voucher-based contingency management, which is the provision of a set amount of incentives for each time a patient comes into treatment. So let's say you would start at $3 for an app, for a negative test, and you would go up to 20 after, 8 sessions or something like that. The other form is called prize-based contingency management, and there patients earn draws to be able to earn money. So it'll be like more of a lottery system. So they earn, let's say, one draw at the beginning and it goes up to 8 draws. And in that version of CM, it's you don't know exactly how much you're going to get each time. But there have been studies looking at what's an effective dose of contingency management. So we know that low incentives are not effective. And the amount of incentives that starts to be effective is like somewhere upwards of $300.
The one thing we know is that if you keep it too low, contingency management doesn't work. And that's our big problem right now in the United States with using our federal funding, is there's a limit of $75, which is well below the what we think is the absolute minimum amount. As Gabby says, $300 is probably right about at the $300 over a 12-week protocol. So the maximum a person could earn would be $300 in using the price-based protocols. In the voucher-based protocols, the amounts have been higher that have been used. We haven't systematically assessed, exactly how much the cutoff is, but we're currently recommending that people use in the neighborhood of $500 to $1,000 over a 12-week protocol. We think that will get a reasonable response. Although I have to say, the research studies that those numbers were based on were done back in the 90s and the early 2000s. With inflation, we probably should be raising the amount above that. But for example, California is using $599 to be delivered over a 24-week period. So we're still working out the optimal amounts.
And so you mentioned kind of the amount that's given at the beginning and how that goes up. But were there any other protocols or dissemination practices that you recommended modifying?
There were a number. So one other big topic was changes to the duration of treatment and re-engagement in treatment. So traditionally, most studies have tested a 12-week version of contingency management, but we know based on research that longer periods of offering contingency management are more effective. And so offering CM for 16 or 24 weeks is, more effective and would be better supported by the evidence. So California, for example, is offering contingency management for 24 weeks. And then different entities have different ways of providing contingency management to patients. So often patients are not able to re-engage in contingency management if they drop out or they're not allowed to repeat contingency management. And all of that was done to prevent fraud and waste and those kinds of concerns. But we don't limit treatment, other kinds of treatment, right? We don't limit cognitive behavioral therapy. Typically, we don't limit the ability to take medications. And so, changing some of the rules around access to contingency management could potentially be effective. And then we also talk about a lot of like policy related changes that could increase access to contingency management.
One thing
Right.
about duration I would just wanted to note is that we know that substance use recovery is a long process, and people need time to stabilize and to get their lives together. And extending CM for additional amounts of time, even if you're talking $300 or $500 or $1,000, that could be actually a very cheap investment in recovery, if you compare it to how much it costs when someone has to go to the emergency department or has to be hospitalized for long periods of time, needs to be in behavioral therapy for months. These things cost a lot of money, and CM can really be seen as a very cost-effective way of maintaining recovery and avoiding some of these things.
And I'd like to add the one of the features of the early and subsequent protocols was something we call the escalation and reset component, where as you give more and more negative samples that are free of stimulant use, the value goes up. So people, as Gabi said, it starts at $3 and it goes up to 20. However, there's also a feature that if you give a positive sample, the amount resets back to an earlier value or to the original value. That, in operant conditioning terms, is a punishment when you do that reset. Now, that was in there specifically to reinforce consecutive abstinence, as in total abstinence. We only want people to be abstinent, which is really not in line with a harm reduction perspective on working to get people to reduce their use. We're not particularly going to be focused only on abstinence. And so that feature of the protocols may or may not be useful. It may the punishing effect when there resets may actually have some negative effects. And so we'd like to see that examined in research.
One other harm reduction related issue that we talk about is right now, contingency management relies on point of care testing, which is testing that can be done in just a few minutes to figure out if somebody is abstinent or not. And those tests only are able to tell, are you abstinent or are you not abstinent? They're not able to evaluate reductions in use. So one thing that would be really helpful is availability of testing to be able to figure out if somebody's reducing their use, even if they're not fully abstinent, to be able to incentivize reductions, and not only, if you're completely abstinent.
You mentioned potential policy implications for increasing access to these programs. I wonder if we could shift the focus now a bit into kind of what does this research say to policymakers and
Yeah, well, I mean, among the most current policy issues we're struggling with is the amount of money that can be used and whether our federal insurance, Medicaid, can pay for this. And if it is going to pay for it, how does it pay for it? What kind of rates do treatment providers get for delivering this? And the idea of having cash incentives or the incentives we use for contingency management, having them available as a benefit through our insurance would be a new idea in the Medicaid system. And there's been a lot of concern at the federal level about, isn't this going to result in fraud and people scamming the system and trying to, and so we have to have guardrails to make sure that it's contingency management is delivered under those circumstances with good accountability and with a well-designed program to ensure, against fraud and abuse. So a lot of the policy issues are around how the money is going to work, and that's brand new. California's project provides one model for doing that, but I'm sure other states are going to want to do other things, and the federal government may want to do it in an entirely different way. But we're just at the beginning of developing that.
And one other thing to note is that contingency management requires frequent testing that is often not covered by insurance. And so having Medicaid and private insurers cover frequent point of care testing in addition to CM sessions themselves, would be very helpful.
Great. So, just moving away from the paper now, is there any plans for you as a team or as individual researchers to carry on kind of moving this line of argumentation forward and to kind of develop the ideas within this paper?
One of the things we're very interested in is, can CM be done remotely? So could someone, rather than having to come into a treatment program 2 or 3 times a week, could they do a drug test at home or some other place, have it be observed by a clinical person and get the reward delivered remotely to their smartphone? So there's a lot to be worked out there, but it would broaden the kinds of people who could participate in CM. It would be particularly helpful in rural areas and other places like that. So that's one of the areas that we're very interested in.
We also have a lot of information on the fact that contingency management is effective. So we know that, and we know a lot less about how to implement it at scale. So, what are some of the barriers and facilitators, and how to make it really accessible to everyone, or at least a large proportion of the population? So, that's another area that we're working on that could really use focus as implementation practices that support contingency management.
And I do have to say that the National Institute on Drug Abuse funded a lot of contingency management research 20 years ago. But I think they reached a point where they said, okay, it works. We get it. It works. However, and so research for on stimulant use disorder really ended about 15 years ago. But as Gabby says, we really do need new data on how to implement it, and we have no data on how do we make this treatment more harm reduction oriented rather than abstinence only oriented. There's really we get a lot of questions on that, and there just is no research literature. So we've been talking to folks at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and I think they're once again interested in the idea of funding research in this area because there's a lot of questions. And when we get asked by policymakers, well, what kind of protocol should I use? Should it be this long? Should it be this much? We really need data to answer those questions. And so I think we're getting the Federal Research Institute back interested in this topic again.
In the introduction of your paper, you really kind of outlined the devastating impacts of the overdose crisis in the US, but also how this intersects with the rise in stimulant use. And I was just wondering, from your perspectives, what can the US government, both at the federal and the state level, be doing differently to try and lower the number of overdoses that we've been seeing rising for the past kind of 10, 15 years? And also, maybe just a comment on how does CM fit into that?
I do think that if you look at virtually all of the literature and announcements for grants and funding for services in the United States that is designed to reduce the overdose crisis, literally 100% of it is aimed at opioid use. In fact, that the overdose crisis is referred to as the opioid overdose crisis. We just finished a small project here where we've interviewed people at a syringe exchange about what drugs are they currently using, what's driving their drug use. And right around 50% say their primary drug is either cocaine or methamphetamine. And the reason they go out and buy drugs is to get cocaine and methamphetamine. Now, fentanyl, which is a powerful opioid, has made its way into the entire drug supply. So when you buy cocaine in the United States or methamphetamine, there's a very good chance you're going to get fentanyl, and you may die from that fentanyl dose. And so that's kept the policymakers focused exclusively on opioids. How do we keep people from dying from fentanyl? The thing they don't understand, and that we've had very difficult time getting them to understand, is much of the drug use is being driven by stimulant use disorder. And unless you provide effective treatment for stimulant use disorder, you're not going to be addressing what drives those people's drug use and puts them at extremely high risk for overdose. I think it's a big area where contingency management could play a major role in reducing overdose deaths, but we haven't gotten the message across to as many policymakers as we need to.
And there's a need in general to increase access to evidence-based treatments. And so contingency management for stimulant use, but also medications for opiate use disorder and, you know, alcohol use disorder, and harm reduction services like provision of naloxone, et cetera, especially in underserved communities who are not getting those services at this point.
One of the things about contingency management is that it's a very popular treatment. And one of the real problems we have is that a lot of the other treatments we have are just not that appealing. And contingency management is. People like the opportunity to earn money. And so it could be particularly useful in getting people who would otherwise not avail themselves of treatments that are out there to actually start.
It's not only patients who love it, providers really love delivering it too. So I just wanted to note that as well.
Brilliant. Well, Dr. Kazanov, Professor McKay, and Professor Rawson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.